Previously on Beta.
It was Thursday, February 8th. It was clear in Los Angeles. We were working the day watch out of personnel division. The boss is Captain Sansing. My partner's Bill Gannon. My name's Friday.
It's been all of the above. Can't get enough. People can't get enough of it.
She was 18 years old.
She doesn't even know what Netscape is.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, author Chuck Klosterman explores a time when people still used fax machines. And if you're someone who still does use a fax machine, I have a question for you. Why? It was also a time when people drank transparent beverages, and there were these things called phone books. It was the 90s.
In a lot of ways, the most important things about Nirvana were not the songs they made, but sort of how they felt about those songs being beloved.
Also, Steven Satterfield takes us behind the scenes of his captivating Netflix docuseries, High on the Hog, how African-American cuisine transformed America.
It's really a tale of the origins of African-Americans as told through food.
But first, Thomas Lennon. He's reunited with the cast of Reno 911 for a movie called Reno 911, The Hunt for QAnon. Thomas has played Lieutenant Jim Dangle for almost 20 years now. Reno 911 originated as a mockumentary on Comedy Central, a parody of the long-running propaganda series Cops. Thomas has also appeared in many films and TV shows, and he's co-written screenplays for the Night at the Museum movie franchise. As if that's not enough, Thomas is the author of the young adult series of novels about a young detective named Ronan Boyle. He was also a member of the groundbreaking comedy troupe The State, which had a show on MTV in the early 90s.
You know, we actually were a comedy group in 1988. We became a comedy group with a bunch of other people at NYU. But from that very specific group, like a really weird amount of people stayed in comedy and are still like very busy, people that you'll see all the time, like David Wayne and Michael Showalter, you know, who just did The Eyes of Tammy Faye, and the guys who did Wet Hot American Summer, and Ken Marino from Party Down, and Joe Latruglio from Brooklyn Nine-Nine. So we're all part of sort of, in the 80s, we imagined ourselves as like a Wooster group, if that's a weird reference. But we, maybe we thought we were more like, you know, The Clash. We felt like we were the only comedy group that mattered. So I guess there's something relentless about us. You know, that said, you know, we've never gone beyond cult status ever. So, yeah, we've done a great job of doing being not that famous for over a quarter century.
You all seem to have this Larry David Curb Your Enthusiasm Project Greenlight system where if the funny or inspiration hits, you make another film. And it's been, I think, nearly 15 years since Reno 911 Miami. What was it about QAnon that made you want to do another movie?
This was a weird one because, you know, we've never done a political sketch, to my knowledge, really of any kind. We did, to my knowledge, the only political sketch we've ever done on Reno 911 was we did a parody of Waiting for Godot. And the joke was that Junior and Dangle were waiting in the desert for George W. Bush's motorcade to go by. And it never, ever came.
We're in the right place, right?
Well, this is where we're waiting.
Yeah. I said Bush was going to be right here.
Through here.
Through here. What?
Not right here, through here.
Who?
Bush.
Oh, Bush. Right.
You know, we did verbatim, like beat for beat, the entire play Waiting for Godot, and no one ever noticed or cared. So we don't do, you know, we don't do a ton of political stuff. So the weird thing that happened was that Paramount Plus, you know, the streaming version of Paramount, came and said, would you guys like to make a movie? And we said, absolutely. We can roll out of bed and make a movie. And they said, great, here's the title. It's called Reno 911, The Hunt for QAnon. And we said, wouldn't that be Reno 911, The Hunt for Q? And they said, shut up. Do you want to do the movie or not? You have to use this title. And we said, oh, well, yeah, sure. And, you know, we thought, you know, there's a weird thing about Reno 911, which is, you know, I mean, our joke was always that somehow Reno 911 appeals to tons of recreational drug users and law enforcement, like in equal parts. And I think after a long bit of trying to figure that out, like, why were we the cop show that survived? You know, there was all the copaganda shows got canceled, but we actually got picked up. Our final season got picked up, or our seventh season got picked up, the day that the actual show Cops got canceled.
These last few years, it's been a nightmare to be a cop. You're walking on eggshells, and it's twice as bad for someone like me, maybe like 100 times as bad, because I hate everybody. I literally can't stand humanity. So for me, I got to get over hating everybody, or my individual hatreds come off like prejudice.
We were never NYPD Blue. We were never like a bunch of, you know, badass cops who were, you know, if we kick down doors, we get hurt and then we just fall down through the door and there's no one ever on the other side that we're looking for, you know. So I think our survival was based on, and then, which led to a weird thing, you know, the fact that it's all sort of improvised and our conversations derail instantly and sound like real people talking. Many police officers say that we're the most accurate cop show on TV.
Interesting.
And they weren't kidding when they said it to me.
Right. Yeah, you really took full comedy advantage of the wackadoodle craziness of QAnon with the new movie. It seems to me that it's a great match for the lunacy of Reno 911. Was it?
That's what's so perfect. Like I think if they did, like, you know, if like Blue Bloods or something, you know, was going to go at, we're going after Q. Yeah, that's just too silly. But like, yeah, there's something about when you hear the QAnon theories, and of course when you see the reveal in our film of what Q and where the Q theories come from. I'm very pleased about that. I don't want to spoil it, obviously, but there's something about the level of competence of our, you know, it's like you could put the Reno 911 squad, like, you could put us up against the Muppets, you know? You could put us up against, but I feel like that's why it kind of works. Like, there's something just ever so slightly cartoonishly dumb about us that pairs, yeah, we do pair well with something like that.
The actual Q, we need to put this in the hand and serve Q.
How are we supposed to find Q? The whole thing about Q is that nobody knows where Q is.
Nobody knows.
That's the whole thing.
Is Q even a person?
We got to put it in the trunk of Mr. Snuffleupagus.
All right, wait, are you saying Snuffleupagus or Upagus?
Upagus.
Oh my God! You've got to get into this again.
I'm sick of
you two arguing.
Home break.
It's Upagus.
What was it like to put on those short shorts again?
You know, it's never been. It was never great the first time. So at the first time I was wearing the shorts, I was 29. I'm now 51. Oh, no, there is a great aspect of that, and I think most folks know the world of fabrics has definitely gotten better. I mean, we have now much more high-tech sort of shorts. So the shorts definitely, they're a little more forgiving in my 50s than they were in my late 20s.
Mm-hmm. And you also had this kind of weird, is this a spoiler to talk about the actual outfit you wore?
No, my romper. My
short
QAnon
shorts,
romper.
Your romper, yes.
I'm really proud of the QAnon romper.
You should be.
We put some time into that. I was like, well, so the notion, without any spoilers, the idea is we would go undercover, presenting ourselves as followers of the Q, and which led to some really amazing outfits. And I've got a patriotic QAnon outfit that also I got because Dangle's always been an out gay character. I've got Pride Q flags on it. It's really just wonderful. If they make a new action figure of me, the Pride QAnon Don't Tread on Me romper just ticks a lot of weird boxes for folks, I think.
You know? Absolutely, and I don't think it's a question of if. I think it's a question of when they make the action figure. They've got to make it. They're hopefully working on it now.
They've got to be.
Yeah, it looks like you all had a blast filming this. So I got to ask, how often do you guys break while you're filming?
When we do, it's pretty hard. We've gotten a little bit better at it. There was the worst time I laughed in this film, and I think you can probably see it a little bit on camera. We get shown to, so of course we go on this QAnon cruise, but the department is paying our bills. So we've been put in the lowest possible cruise ship package you can be in, which is basically we're down like below steerage.
Yeah.
And so Kulop Velysok, who's a great improviser in L.A., and she plays sort of the, she's like the mistress who is the head of like ship operations. She shows us down into steerage where we're going to be, where we're going to be sleeping for the next couple days. And Wendy McClendon Covey, who plays Clemmy, of course, she looked up off camera and she said, are those bats that I'm seeing up in the corner there? And if you watch my, you can see my face. It's in the film.
What's below executive double bottom?
Nothing.
You
are lowest.
Right. This is rustic. Almost to a fall.
It's nicer than that place we had in Laughlin.
By a lot. And yes.
Do you know the best part?
Yeah.
No windows.
Yeah. I have a hard time getting to sleep sometimes, but I feel like there's so little oxygen in here that it's going to be pretty easy.
Do you want to work a little bit when you sleep, you know?
Earn your life.
Uh-huh. Earn your life.
Earn your life.
Earn the trip, yeah. You know?
Is that a bat? Those aren't bats up there.
Oh, yes.
Those are bats.
Yes.
Okay.
They come with the room complimentary.
Oh, they're moving. Look, they're moving. Just a little bit. They're wiggling around.
Beautiful.
Oh,
there's
a
baby.
Oh, that's a baby.
But if you see my face, I look real angry and I'm trying to concentrate about something. But that's just me. That's just me. That's just me responding, accurately to her saying, are there bats hanging on the ceiling of this room here? And of course, the answer, because it's an improv show, is, oh, yes. Yes, of course.
Yes. Yes, yeah. And.
It's
yes.
Always yes.
Is there anyone that breaks everyone?
Most of the folks on the squad have gotten very good about keeping it together, because we've been doing the show for quite a long time now. And also, of course, if you break, we have to stay longer and do it again. So Carlos is the worst. Carlos laughs a lot. There's a new thing I started doing between season 7 and 8 where, we've been doing this long enough. I'm now just playing a game where I'm only trying to make Wendy break at all of our morning briefings. So what I did was there's a game where we don't use them every time, but I announce what new like app or local service is sponsoring our station for that day's morning briefing. And it's just a game where I get Wendy, but like my favorite one was Panda Fridge, which is refrigerators only when you need them. and then one called Soup Gorilla, which is if you want the ingredients for soup delivered and you're not in a rush, so you don't mind if soup ingredients get to your door within a pretty reasonable couple of days or not much more than that, Soup Gorilla. And then it's really just me trying to make Wendy laugh. And I've been getting pretty good at it.
I really liked what you were doing on stage today.
I noticed.
Listen, I am waxed, chillaxed, and unvaxed, so.
In addition to leading one of the most famous cult comedy troupes and making cameos in big blockbuster comic book movies and leading network sitcoms, you are also the author of the New York Times best-selling Ronan Boyle series of young adult books. Can you tell us a little bit about the series?
I can. So it all kind of started. I was in Ireland on a family trip. We kind of go a lot. My grandparents are from Ireland, obviously. And so I was in Ireland in a castle called Turin Castle, which is in County Mayo, a little tower castle. And someone showed me what a real Irish shillelagh looks like. Mm-hmm. And I always pictured them as like cute, sort of a cute little walking stick, or something that would be in the Lucky Charms box, like Shereer shillelaghs. And no, it turns out it's like a major heavy-duty weapon from when Irish people weren't allowed, to carry swords. So I just sort of got my wheels turning, and I'd always wanted to write sort of a funny fantasy novel, a little bit in the inspiration, obviously, being Douglas Adams and The Hitchhiker's Guide and all those books. So I ended up writing 3 novels now, and there at some point will be a film from DreamWorks, and it's called Ronan Boyle. The first one's Ronan Boyle and the Bridge of Riddles, Ronan Boyle and the Swamp of Certain Death, and then the new one is called Ronan Boyle Into the Strange Place. And basically, they follow a 16-year-old kid from Galway who gets sort of accidentally recruited into the special unit of Tiernanogue, which is the police force in Ireland that has to deal with leprechauns, cluricons, banshees, harpies, shearies, all of the sort of mythological Irish creatures. And It's been enormously fun. They're very fun. Yeah, the books have sold well, and people keep finding them. And I think I was never really a super strong reader until I got to things that made me laugh out loud. And so I think my real intention with the Ronan Boyle books was write books that young people would laugh out loud during, not kind of. They should be, hopefully you'll laugh till you scream. So was the intention.
Yeah, they're very funny.
Books. Thanks.
Yeah, they are very funny. Mission accomplished. How does your comedy writing influence your fiction and vice versa?
I feel ultimately like it's all part of one thing. I feel like I like to write compulsively. I was very lucky, kind of young, to I had a mentor whose name is Peter Hedges, and he was my teacher at theater camp at Northwestern in Chicago, where I was at theater camp, actually with Carrie Kenney, who would later be Trudy Weigel on Reno 911. So this was in 1987. We were 17 years old, and Peter, who would go on to write What's Eating Gilbert Grape and An Ocean in Iowa and a bunch of really cool novels and plays and things, he got in my head when I was that young, and he made me think that writing every day was a really cool way to be. It was just cool. It was like riding a motorcycle or something, but cheaper. And I was I'm going to be like this guy. And so I just started sort of patterning my, but I still write every day, even if I'm just sort of trying something out, or I'll write a sketch for no reason sometimes, just to do it.
That's great. Again,
it's a bit of a compulsion maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's good. It's a good compulsion, I would say. And we're the beneficiaries of it. So thank you for being so compulsive with your writing.
Thank you.
Thomas Lennon, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on all of your multimedia success, and we look forward to your future successes.
What an absolute pleasure. This was so fun.
Thomas Lennon is Lieutenant Jim Dangle in Reno 911, The Hunt for QAnon. He's also the author of the Ronan Boyle series of young adult novels. Find out more at WPR.org/beta.
I don't think that I'll look back on this book and be embarrassed by it in 20 years. Because there are things from my early books that I know if I went back and reread, I would be embarrassed by.
Coming up, author Chuck Klosterman takes us back to the 90s. So grab your favorite plaid flannel shirt, your fanny pack, and an ice-cold Crystal Pepsi. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Remember the 1990s? Of course you do, unless you were born in the year 2000 or later. And if that's the case, we here at Beta should pat ourselves on the back for attracting such a young demographic. Well done, gents.
Woo-hoo!
But I digress. Chuck Klosterman remembers the 1990s. He spent most of his 20s during that decade. And he's written what will probably be considered the definitive book about this time period. It's called The 90s. Chuck explores everything you wanted to know about the 90s and some things that you might be afraid to remember.
Emphysema.
I'm the king of the world!
Cringeworthy, Chuck shared his understanding of the 1990s with us.
I guess to me, if you're essentially trying to understand the period in a kind of an abstract way, it would probably be the prevalence of the idea of selling out and how that sort of complicated the lives of any young person in the 90s with aspirations to do almost anything, that they had to factor in this specific way of understanding fame and success that consistently seemed to be create a psychological obstacle toward just going out and being who you were. You always had to consider how that was perceived within the context of fame or success. I really feel like selling out is what the 90s were about, not the activity, but the fear of it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You say that Nirvana's album Nevermind, which was released in 1991, is the official launch of the 90s and that it is the ideal mainstream version of counterculture ideology. How so?
Well, you know, there's a kind of a conventional way to frame the 90s. We never go exactly by the calendar because culture doesn't really care about clocks or calendars. But the conventional take on when the 90s began and when they ended is that they began when the Berlin Wall fell in autumn of 89, and then they end at 9/11. I don't see the 90s beginning in 89. And the reason I feel that way is because 1990, the year itself, was sort of the 1980s on autopilot. Many of the things that we associate with the 1980s were still very central to the year 1990. I mean, sure, like Twin Peaks begins that year, and that seems new, but it's kind of a fringe concern. The most popular show is still Cheers. You know, Joe Montana is still the best player in the NFL. People are still shopping through catalogs and buying, you know, Garfield phones from the JCPenney catalog around Christmas. The New Kids on the Block had a major tour in 1990. It wasn't until the release of Nevermind that we see sort of the values we now associate with that period becoming the main values of youth culture. And the rippling effect in a non-musical way that Nirvana had sort of on society is pretty profound. I talk about a commercial for a Subaru Impreza starring Jeremy Davis, an early role he would later go on to be like in Saving Private Ryan and TV shows like Lost. But yes. he's describing this Subaru car.
You remember when rock and roll was really boring and corporate? Well, punk challenged all this and said, hey, excuse me, but here's what's cool about music, remember? Now, Subaru, with this Impreza, is challenging some car thinking here. This car is all about reminding you and me what's great about a car and moving forward and making cars better and less disappointing. Just like punk, except it's cars.
And what he's really trying to do is appeal to people who would normally buy a Honda Civic, but they're trying to sell them these Imprezas. The analogy he uses is punk rock, how this car is like punk rock. And he jumps back to the idea of the 1970s where, you know, I guess bands like Jethro Tull and Yes had made rock boring. So then these punk bands came in and changed everything. But what he's really talking about is Nirvana. He can't talk directly about Nirvana because they would never participate in a car commercial. It would also be a situation where if he actually used Nirvana as the example, it would have had the opposite effect. It would have seemed like he was trying too hard. So he had to talk about Nirvana without talking about Nirvana. And how do you do that? Well, it's by suggesting that your product, whatever you're trying to sell, sort of contains the values alleged by Nirvana themselves, which was chiefly a real discomfort with any kind of conventional success, to the point where the idea of being super famous was not seen as the achievement of your career, but really humiliating. And I think that a lot of these ideas, like we talk about selling out and all these things, I mean, like, this is something Nirvana was dealing with, because what had always happened in the past is there had been a tension between mainstream culture and underground culture. So it was understandable for the underground to look at mainstream success with a lot of skepticism and sort of see it pejoratively. But then Nirvana kind of, not accidentally, but not necessarily aggressively, becomes the biggest band in the world. So then we have a situation where somebody who identifies as the underground is now the absolute top of the pyramid. And that became a real paralyzing thing for them. And in a lot of ways, the most important things about Nirvana was not the songs they made, but sort of how they felt about those songs being beloved.
Yeah, exactly. In one of my favorite chapters, you talk about Quentin Tarantino's 1992 film, Reservoir Dogs. Why could this movie only be made in the 90s?
You know, the 70s had been a time in film that was a director's medium. So probably the greatest period film may ever experience was certainly the first half of the 1970s. In the 1980s, it became more of a producer's medium. So you did see more kind of formulaic filmmaking. Film was not as good in the 80s as it had been in the decade before. But then in the early 90s, there's this explosion in independent film. It wasn't just that they were directing these films. They were writing them. They were directing them. They had almost complete control over everything. And he is an example of somebody who represents how the VCR and video cassettes really changed filmmaking. I mean, you know, the VCR is a 1980s thing, okay? It's the story of the VCR is an 80s story. That's when they sort of became something that people commonly own. They'd been too expensive in the past, and suddenly it was very easy to own one. And that, of course, led to the creation of the video store. And what the video store did is it allowed people who didn't live in Los Angeles or New York to have access to a much wider library of film. where they could create their own sort of personal specific film canon. And someone like Quentin Tarantino, in the movie like Reservoir Dogs is an example of this. This is a movie that someone might think, oh, well, this guy must have had some family relationship to organized crime. In fact, like Harvey Keitel, when he read the script, just assumed, because Tarantino has an Italian name and didn't know this guy, he must have had like some criminals in his family history, and was shocked to find out that, you know, Quentin Tarantino was a guy from Tennessee who then moved to LA with his mom and had no crime at all in his life. All he had was crime movies. And a movie like Reservoir Dogs is not about life. It is about the world of crime as it had been expressed in other films.
No, he ain't familiar. He ain't one of Cabot's soldiers either. He's got to be from out of town. Joe knows him real good.
How can you tell?
The way they talk to each other. You can tell they're real buddies.
Two of you talk?
Who, me and Joe?
Mr. White.
A little.
About what?
Brewers.
Milwaukee Brewers?
Yeah. Apparently they won the night before. He made a killing off him.
Now this is sweet, man, because if this crook's a Brewers fan, his ass has got to be from Wisconsin. And I bet you everything from a diddle dad Joe to a damn defense.
So what you see in the 90s is this idea of content being built out of content. You could go into a Blockbuster and there was enough content in one Blockbuster to almost usurp all of actual reality. And this is where you see, this is part of the reason why it was so common in the 90s to classify things as postmodern. There was this idea that we were now moving beyond what had been sort of the modern idea of filmmaking, which is, you know, represent life, capture life, and now make it this very subjective thing where somebody could kind of take their idea of a fictionalized life and then make it hyper-real on screen.
Yeah, that's a very good point. As you point out, almost everything about television that was recognized in the early 90s can be boiled down to 1 3-second clip from the fourth season of Seinfeld. What is that clip?
Well, it's a clip from an episode called The Pitch. And this is a two-part episode where the main characters, Jerry Seinfeld and George Costanza, who's really a stand-in for Larry David, Jerry's real-life friend, they're trying to make a TV show based kind of on the banality of their own life, which is what Seinfeld was. Like, Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld make a TV show about them just sitting around talking about, you know, what they find mildly amusing. And then within the reality of that show, they're trying to make another level. They're trying to make a show called Jerry. Okay, that's good, like about their own life. And they're pitching this show to NBC.
Oh, no. No stories.
No stories? So what is it?
What did you do today?
I got up and came to work.
There's a show. That's a show.
How is that a show?
Well, maybe something happens to you on the way to work.
No, 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 nothing happens.
Well, something happens.
Well, why am I watching it?
Because it's on TV.
Not yet.
That just seems kind of obtuse and just sort of a throwaway, but it really does reflect how differently television was viewed just a short time ago. I mean, the 90s aren't that long ago. Like, you know, we're not looking back on like some period before World War II. It's relatively close to us in kind of the historical lineage, but things like the way we view television have changed entirely. Things like appointment television, this television show you had to watch. The idea that if someone watched a TV show and you had yet to watch it, they can't talk about it because it will spoil it. Nobody would have ever thought that in the 90s. Like, it was more likely to say, I don't even own a TV. That was a popular thing people said. TV [S2] Yeah. [S1] Was seen as very, very inferior to theatrical film. You could tell someone on a television show was really successful because they would leave TV and make a movie. So this idea that George was expressing was like, you know, what people want to do is turn the television on and see what's there. And if we put this on, people will do that. Because the idea was that television was still a very passive experience. It was what you did when there was nothing else better to do. And that just happened to be most of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. You were in your 20s for most of the 90s, and in an essay you wrote for Grantland in 2011, you analyzed what you called the nostalgia problem. Do you think nostalgia was a problem for you while you were writing the 90s?
You know, when people talk or write about this book, they use the word nostalgia inevitably. I think people look at the cover of this book and they see this old phone and they're like, oh, I remember having that phone, or know someone who had that phone, and they kind of feel a sense of nostalgia. But people sometimes confuse the concept of nostalgia with just the activity of remembering things. I mean, to me, nostalgia means you're looking back in an event and you're using your own emotional relationship to change how that event seems in your memory. This is why somebody who grew up during the Depression can look back at the 30s and say, oh, it was such a wonderful time. They're remembering things about themselves that had no relationship to the status of the country, injecting that back into the memory and changing what it is. This book is not nostalgic in that way. Like, I wrote Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs 20 years ago. That's also a book about the 90s. But that was a very personal book about the 90s. That was about my life and the things I cared about and my understanding of reality through the things I was into. This book isn't like that. I mean, I'm not in this book. I looked at this much more as a, I don't want to say academic, but it was a process that did not involve my feelings. I don't think that I'll look back on this book and be embarrassed by it in 20 years. Because there are things from my early books that I know if I went back and reread, I would be embarrassed by. I guess not because they were published, but because I would be like, I'm just, that person's not me now. And to a lot of people, it always will be, because this might be the only thing they know about me, this one book they read once, you know?
Can you give me an example of something you'd be embarrassed about? You're embarrassed about in your previous books?
Okay, so my third book was called Killing Yourself to Live. And, you know, there's a lot of things in that book that, to me, like are kind of amazing that they happened. Like, I met my wife while writing that book. I was writing that book in kind of a diary form. So there's a few pages in Killing Yourself to Live where I literally explain what happened on the night I met my wife, written the day after it happened. I mean, I'm sure anybody listening to this interview is like, oh, I remember when I met my spouse, but you probably didn't go home and write about it, you know, that night by chance. Yeah. So in that way, it's really incredible to me. I have these personal details of my life captured in this way that I could have never anticipated. But that said, I would never write a book like that again. I would never talk so candidly about my own interior life, and I would absolutely never talk so casually about other people. I mean, I talk about various women that I had relationships with in that book, and I just did it. I just didn't think about what it meant. I just did it, you know? I guess in my mind, I thought, well, you know, if they wrote a book about their relationships and I was in it, I'd be interested. I'd be curious. But of course, all people aren't that way. Like, some people don't feel that way. So, you know, I think of, like, my first three books, which I'm sure to some people will always be the books of mine they like the most, as these things that I wouldn't do anymore. Because it's just, I would not write about my own life, because that would mean writing about my relationship with my wife, writing about my kids, you know, writing about these things that are, that now to me seem kind of too intimate and personal to use as a commodity. But maybe that's 90s thinking. Maybe in some ways it's me finally catching up to this idea of selling out and sort of what integrity and all these things that I refuse to do just to be successful. Because I'm always pushed to write more about myself in this book. I'm sure my publisher and my agent would have loved me to do a first person telling of the 90s. I know they would have. But that's not who I am anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as you mentioned, you've kind of covered that in Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs. Chuck Klosterman, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. Congratulations on the 90s.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Chuck Klosterman is the author of The 90s. Find out more at wpr.org/beta.
I think that food has a unique ability to help us get to dialogue and to understanding in a way that other conversation and other vessels just simply cannot.
Coming up, Stephen Satterfield talks about his Netflix docuseries, High on the Hog, how African-American cuisine transformed America. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're looking for a show that explores food, history, and travel, then look no further than the Netflix docuseries High on the Hog, How African-American Cuisine Transformed America. This four-part series combines food, history, and travel to create a compelling portrait of exploring Black history through the lens of African-American cuisine. High on the Hog was created by an all-Black creative team that traveled to various locations around the globe, including Benin, West Africa, Texas, and Philadelphia. Food writer Steven Satterfield is the host of the show. He told Beta's Steve Gotcher about how he got involved.
I was actually just fortunate to be a part of a larger vision of adapting a very important and renowned text into a television series. And so the book was originally written about 10 years ago by Dr. Jessica B. Harris, a food scholar and historian. And it's really a tale of the origins of African Americans as told through food. And so we take a journey that begins in Benin, West Africa, through the Atlantic into Charleston, and so on, moving chronologically through the series as we do through the Black American experience.
And why was it important to begin in Benin?
Yeah, a lot of people may not be aware of Benin's history and role in the trade of human beings, but Benin is a place where off the coast of Africa, among other goods and cargo, humans were taken in captivity and brought into slavery. In the US, I think many people obviously know this story, but Benin is a pretty small country with an outsized importance in history in this trade.
I felt as though I was stepping back in time in Abomey. I mean, this is a place where you can still walk the actual road the enslaved walked. It was a vile march, a march that ended in a city called Ouidah, where so many of us left, never to return again.
How have the foods that the slaves brought over to this country, how important have they become to the way we eat?
I mean, I think in more ways than we can count. We certainly learn about the rice crucible in the second episode of High on the Hog. And I think the thing about the rice in particular, Oryza glabrima, which is a derivative of West Africa, the famous Carolina gold rice that we learn about, it's not just that it was a culinary delicacy, it's that it was an economic boon for the United States. This was the most coveted, the most well-known rice in the entire world. And so in order to take a grain and turn it into a profitable commodity, you really need culinary know-how, yes, but you need agricultural know-how too.
So where did the rice disappear to?
A combination of a lot of things, but it boils down to this. African expertise to grow the rice disappeared. Slavery is over. They didn't have a business model to go to, and it just blew up in everyone's face.
It's staggering to realize that Charleston had a nearly 80% decrease in rice production after the Civil War.
I think just as much as we think about, you know, the derivative dishes that come later that we learn about, like macaroni and cheese, they're a little bit more well-known. But what I like to also point out is that a lot of the knowledge and influence happens, you know, from an agricultural perspective as well.
At the end of the first episode, you visited a mass grave in Benin, and it was a very, very powerful moment. Tell me about your experience and what that was like for you.
You know, I think for me, it was really a feeling of, I think a lot of folks who have had the experience of a kind of homecoming, an ancestral homecoming, going to one's country of origin from the perspective of a refugee, even if that is a multi-generational experience, that kind of separation, I do believe that the reverberations move across generations as well. And so for me as a Black man who grew up in the South, to be in West Africa, to understand that the ground that I was standing on was the side of my ancestors who didn't survive to make that horrific voyage, who weren't healthy or well enough to even make that voyage, was a really overwhelming moment. You know, I think not an experience, and just in terms of the emotional quality, that is unique to me. I think many people have felt similarly in their own version of homecoming.
The only power that the newly enslaved had was the power of refusal.
That's right.
And so they could sometimes say no and refuse to eat and shut their mouth. And they invented a diabolical tool. It was called the speculum oris, so that they could be force-fed. Because people resisted. Resistance was every step of the journey.
I love this notion of food and the refusal of it being a way for us to take back power.
Yeah, power of no.
That's right.
The power of no, I won't eat that.
Right.
And that's what you have in the marrow of your bones, too.
That's right.
I'm curious what you learned about your history and yourself that surprised you by making High on the Hog.
Wow. That's a good question. I think that my prevailing sentiment was I was just tremendously humbled on a personal level. You know, Dr. Jessica B. Harris is and has long been one of my favorite scholar, a scholar whose work has impacted my life and my own curiosity about food as a means of exploring Black history and culture. And so to have been able to be with her in Benin, a place that she's been traveling for, gosh, I don't know, almost 50 years, maybe, and writing about, it's still something that I will struggle to comprehend that actually happened in my life. And I'm tremendously grateful. I don't know if that's like a lesson, but I really was and remain so humbled for the experience.
It's an amazing thing to witness on the screen. And I imagine being there must have been cathartic.
Yeah, no, it was, I mean... Look, the things that you see on the screen as far as me convening and breaking bread, that is as real as it gets, you know, the joy and euphoria I felt around people like Gabrielle Carter, around BJ Dennis, Michael Twitty. I mean, and that was just here in the States, you know, with my brothers and sisters on the continent. We haven't really seen anything like High on the Hog on food television. And so as someone who's deeply impacted by food media, grew up watching food media, I really was so in awe of the experience, not only as someone who got to partake in it, but just as a unique offering in the space. And I really, really hope that it is indicative of a direction where we're going, because I think there's a lot of richness and context and nuance that we're able to garner when the host has a kind of cultural connection to a place. But having a Black production crew and having a Black host and having the material really move through someone, you know, who has lived the Black American experience makes for really authentic and emotionally powerful moments like the one we see at the end of the first episode. And I think that folks who consume television and other kinds of media can tell, you know, what that difference is like on a personal level versus the perspective of sort of a tourist or passerby.
The beginning of the fourth episode, Freedom, grabs your attention right away. It's a 1941 recording of Laura Smalley, a former slave. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so that episode is the onset of the story of Juneteenth, which is ultimately a liberation story.
You remember when the Civil War was being fought?
Well, I can't remember much about it, but I remember this much. We all got up and all of them went to the house. Went to the house to see old Master. And I thought old Master was dead, but he had been off to the war and come back. All the niggas gathered around to see old Master again. You know, and old Master didn't tell you, it was free.
He didn't tell you that?
No, he didn't tell. They wait till, I think now they said they wait till 6 months out of that. 6 months. And turn them loose on the 19th of June. That's why you know you celebrate that day, colored folks. Celebrate that day.
The thing about Juneteenth that I like to interject is that, you know, Galveston, Texas, again, talking about geographic proximity, is really a go-between for traders and colonists and just a center of activity and commerce. And so Texas, just from a geographic perspective, was quite isolated from the rest of the South, the Southeastern United States, where slavery was thriving. And so they were the last to find out about their own liberation. And so the beginning of the fourth episode kind of sets the stage for this revelation of freedom.
You also discovered a barbecue joint in Huntsville, Texas, attached to the New Zion Missionary Baptist Church. And there seemed to be a spiritual element involved in creating and eating barbecue and soul food. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the New Zion Church is so interesting because it is a blending and a melding of these two very specific but intertwined parts of Black American culture, of barbecue and church and religion. And so, you know, it begins pretty humbly, like, you know, many churches have after service picnics or convenings. But the barbecue was so good that it actually became a way to kind of subsidize the church itself.
And around lunchtime, Sister Ward began to cook food for their dinner, and she got a foot tub. And that foot tub, she put a refrigerator rack over it and began to grill meat. And she said that we couldn't cook for people stopping and asking of you selling barbecue. The very next week, she borrowed $50 from the church and began a business, New Zion Barbecue.
We did, I think, initially report that New Zion had gone out of business, but I believe they're still there. So
that's great.
Good news.
Why do you think food is such an effective way to explore African-American history?
Well, I think that it's not just an important way to explore African-American history, but human history. I think that food has a unique ability to help us get to dialogue and to understanding in a way that other conversation and other vessels just simply cannot. And the reason for that is because food is the one singular experience that we all share as diversified people. There's just so much to learn about our place in the world, not only today, but in a way that explains how we got to where we are. So I think it's the most enlightening way to better understand and engage with the human experience.
I'm really encouraged to know that there's going to be another season of High on the Hog. What's planned for the upcoming season?
Funny enough, I actually don't know. And I know that that's probably surprising, but we're still trying to piece that together. We're almost there. What I can say is that it will be a chronological continuation of the book. And so we kind of break at Texas at this moment of emancipation, and we will resume the story from there.
Stephen Satterfield, it's a great pleasure to talk to you. Congratulations on High on the Hog. We look forward to the second season. Thanks again.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it.
Stephen Satterfield is the host of the Netflix docuseries High on the Hog, How African-American Cuisine Transformed America. Find out more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Thomas Lennon, Chuck Klosterman, and Stephen Satterfield. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, Beta is now available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Just going to look for a new bicycle. Something, you know, a little flashy, but within my price range.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I'm not your little dapper Dan doll, okay?
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
I don't want to work here without a mustache. I really don't.